Coming up on Life is a Festival.
What is your primary tool for working with the mind that causes suffering and cultivating more joy in your life?
So Vipassana is the main one. I think really exploring creative expression and music. For me, it's music. And really diving deep into this has been so helpful in allowing myself to find new ways of expressing myself. I think that's very important. And time in nature is the most beautiful one. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about joy and what it can give to you. And okay, oftentimes these discussions are centered to us. But the most beautiful thing about joy is that is giving. It's sharing it with others.
It's contagious.
I never saw myself as a joyful person. I put joy at the end of my name on Instagram because people started to say, you are joy, you are joy, you are joy. It was projected on me.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. Well, we've been dealing with some serious topics on this show lately, and I thought that it might be time for a little bit of joy. So on the program, I mentioned this quote, but I did not have it memorized. So I want to start today's episode with one of my favorite Rumi quotes. Sorrow prepares you for joy. It violently sweeps everything out of your house so that new joy can find space to enter. It shakes the yellow leaves from the bough of your heart so that fresh green leaves can grow in their place. It pulls up the rotten roots so that new roots hidden beneath have room to grow. Whatever sorrow shakes from your heart, far better things will take their place. There is a hope that as we clear space in our hearts, that space may be filled with joy. But how do we connect with joy? How do we find joy? What is joy? Well, I decided to speak to the most joyful person I know. Victorian and I have been friends for many years. He is a French DJ, a flautist, and a social impact entrepreneur. And he seems to have joy figured out. So Victorian and I were together at a co-living, co-working mastermind for experienced designers and community builders called Experience House recently in Morocco. And we had been talking about doing a podcast for a long time. So we finally got a chance to sit down in person. And I wanted to talk to Victorian about joy. And he did not disappoint. On the show, we discuss what joy is. And we get right into the tools that he uses to cultivate joy, starting with his own creativity. And he also shares advice for young artists who are interested in engaging creatively with the world. He also shares the story of how he became big in Pakistan. We discuss the power of nature, which has been a refuge for Victorian for many years. Then we go deep on Vipassana meditation. When people say Vipassana, that actually means insight meditation. So that's a style of meditation. But when people colloquially refer to it, what they're often talking about is a very specific 10-day retreat that was created by a Burmese businessman named Goenka. And these proliferate all over the world. There's a link to it in the show notes. But basically, you sign up and you don't pay anything. It's donation based. And you go, and for 10 days, you sit in silent meditation for 10 and a half hours a day. And this is a very powerful, transformative experience. And it can also be very challenging. Victorian and I have both done two Vipassana retreats, and we've been wanting to talk about it because we have slightly differing opinions. So I think you might enjoy that on the show today. Victorian shares his path of sobriety and how it has helped him cultivate joy by not chasing highs, which is a very interesting aspect for many of us who are psychonauts and seek to expand our consciousness, sometimes in hedonistic ways. Finally, after we finished the show, we weren't quite finished and we got back on the mic to talk about my specific beef with the Honorable S.N. Goenka. So a little playfulness at the end of the show. Victorian is an internationally renowned DJ and co-founder of the group FDVM. He's an accomplished flautist. He has meditations on Insight Timer. He has a new project called Nakaloka, which is a meditative concert presented by Victorian and his partner, Monica Dogra, with flutes, sacred chants, and movement. He also puts energy towards social and environmental actions. He co-created Literally, Bali Live, and other initiatives in a humble effort to invite ecological empathy and support those in need. Victorian is a joy. I mean, that's all there is to it. So please, at the very least, have a joyful hour with this charming French musician. And now here's Victorian.
Victorian, welcome to Life is a Festival. It's been a couple of years we've been talking about having this conversation, and here we are in Morocco, spending time together at Experience House, and what a perfect time and place to discuss joy. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here with you, and I cannot wait to dive into everything with you in this moment.
There's so many places we could start in a conversation about joy. And of course, you and I have discussed that we want to excavate joy. I certainly want to excavate joy. I guess a starting place would be for you, Victorian. You use the word joy in your Instagram handle. You speak of joy. And in my view of you, what I see in the world is that you live a joyful life. Can you define joy? Because it's not the same as happiness or good fortune. It's a specific thing.
Right.
What is joy?
Yeah, I think that's the most important part, is to define it. And many people think joy and happiness are the same thing, and they're definitely not the same thing. Joy is like an unwavering state. You can always live in joy. It's possible, even in the darkest time, in the most difficult times. You can be sad and enjoy. You can be happy and enjoy. So for me, it's like, it's a state that is always present, that one can be in. You just have to realize it.
Joy is a state that one can be in. You just have to realize it.
Yes.
I can't tell you how many times I have not been in the state of joy.
Okay, yeah. That may be true, but also that may be that you were feeling sad or in a dark time, right?
Yeah, well, I think more than anything, preoccupied with my own experience of suffering, my own mental machinations, my desire for things to be different than the way that they are. And to me, that's not a state of joy.
Yes, I can see that. And I can see also how it could be a state of joy. Let's do one thing. Take a breath right now. And exhale. We are living. We are breathing, living humans. And in this moment, just the fact to be alive, even if it's a bad moment or a good moment, is such preciousness. And that's what we call joy. Mm. It's like this ability to tap into what in this present moment is. Not putting it as bad or good, or it's a positive or negative experience, but just like rejoicing into every heartbeat. It's like, okay, I'm having a terrible time right now, yet there's so much to be grateful for. I'm still alive, I'm still breathing. And that in its own is joy.
I think this definition will become more nuanced and complex, and perhaps as well more accessible as we have a conversation about your life and the ways in which you've accessed joy. Mm. So we're setting the table by saying that joy is accessible in every moment.
Yes.
And I don't live in a way where I believe that that is true. I conceptually believe that that could be true. It's not how I live. It seems like it's how you live. Do you feel that you live in a way, not that you are always accessing joy, but in a way where you have an imprint in your being that joy is accessible in every moment, that you can go to that place?
Yes, yes. I'm not saying that I am like always in joy and always in that state, but I know that it's possible. It takes a lot of work, a lot of meditation, a lot of mindfulness. But as you mentioned, like for you, you don't believe that this is necessarily true in your experience, at least. But what we experience here at Experience House is your belief doesn't have to be true. Your belief just has to serve yourself and the greater good. Mm. So I want to believe that this is possible.
That's a bit of a can of worms about belief, because I have a little bit of a suspicion of magical thinking that it doesn't just matter that you believe it. But I do align with you that the fundamental value of faith of any kind is that you set yourself to a certain way of experiencing the world that makes your life and the lives of those around you better. Mm-hmm. So whether that is Christianity that leads you to serve the poor, or whether that's personal growth and development of yourself that leads you to be more joyful. And that it doesn't need to be fundamentally true, because fundamental truth is inaccessible. There is no way to understand universal truth. There is no way to know what is the most righteous way of being. I suppose we're all experimenting with that and finding our own paths.
Yeah, I mean, some people may have found it. When you look at the life of Buddha and his state, you may find that, yeah, there is possibility to find what the ultimate truth is.
But you think so?
Yeah, I think so.
You are a more hopeful man than I. Okay, so let's rewind the clock a bit. Can you think of a time in your life when you felt what to me feels very oppositional to joy, which is despair?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think sadness is oppositional to joy. I think that it's really despair, hopelessness, the sense that there is no light to find. Is there a time in your life when you were deeply in that place and in that belief?
Yeah. When I went through divorce, it was so unexpected, and I found myself with nothing in my apartment in New York, and I was not expecting this moment at all. And I remember clearly, I was like, it's weird, because, and I was not using the word joy at that time, but it felt more contradictory. I was saying, oh, I feel happy to be sad.
Mm. So just to set the tone, how old are you? How long had you been married?
It's 6 years ago. I've been married for 6 years. And in my opinion, everything goes well.
You got married at like 20 then?
25.
Oh, 25?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, we were together for 6 years and married for 6 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm living life, beautiful life. Everything is fine. And then one day she comes and she says, I want the divorce. And I had no idea about it. Like, there was no discussion. There was no negotiation about it. It was just like, hey.
Did she tell you why?
Not really.
To this day?
To this day. The only reason she gave, and I still respect her so much, and we're on good terms and all of that. The only reason she said is that the voice that told me to be with you told me not to be with you anymore.
The voice that told her to be with you told her not to be with you.
Yeah.
Was that voice related to any kind of like religion, or, you know, was it like a relationship with divine in her understanding?
Yes, intuition, divine. Intuition.
It wasn't like just a schizophrenic voice. It's like,
no.
End everything, burn it down.
No. It was not like that. But that being said, I felt despair. I felt like I lost everything. You know, I was planning to build a family and all of this, and everything like kind of crashed. And in that moment, it was very clear to me. I was like, wow, I'm feeling, it's opening a new door. And this door of pain in my heart, at a level I've never experienced it before. And that was a very new experience for me.
What does pain feel like for you? Because for me, pain, physical pain, and even sadness does not bother me that much. But psychological suffering, the spinning of thoughts, the grasping, the kind of addictive spinning nature, the mental distress, to me, that's real suffering. And so the pain of a heartbreak where I actually feel in my body like, oh, this is hard, that I can feel happiness in that space. But the desperate grasping feeling and the mind forms
right
of suffering in relation to pain, that to me is what's most poignant. How does pain feel for you?
Yeah, for me, it's more like in the heart, as you mentioned. I've been really trying to reframe the mind one and really work hard on it. Like everything that's addiction to substances and everything else. I've really like spent a lot of time like listening to it, not judging it, watching it, not being attached to it.
And it means what? You listen to it, you don't judge it, you're not attached to it. What is it?
This voice in your mind that's like going on and on and on and on and on and on that brings you in very dark places.
Okay, that, so that you have the same thing I do of like a voice that brings you to dark places.
I mean, everybody has it.
Okay, well, I just thought maybe you didn't because you were so joyful. I thought maybe you got a little bit of a head start on this that you just didn't have. Like your heart hurt, but you were like, ah, yes,
no,
so poetic.
No. It's there. It's there for everyone. It's there for everyone.
Okay. That's a relief.
Let me bring you. I think Michael A. Singer speaks about this, and I twisted it a little bit. And
this is from Untethered Soul.
It's from Untethered Soul, or it's from the Surrender Experiment, one or the other. So he says something, I forgot what he says, but inspired from that, I made my own, and it's the heart plays the notes of every emotion. And what all we have to do is to dance on every note. And that's what joy is. It's like learn to dance at every moment. Move with the sadness, move with the despair, move with all of it and transform it. And we have this ability. It doesn't mean not being with it and not acknowledging it and not doing the work to transcend it. It's actually part of it. But if you don't know that there is another way, then you get stuck in it. So despair is there, sadness is there, fear is there. Obviously, here we're speaking in a moment when you're not in a physical despair, you know, it's very different. We're talking about emotional situations, right? Physical can happen, but I mean, if there is an outer physical unfolding that you're being attacked physically, for example. So in this moment of feeling emotions and torment and sadness, you have the ability, and knowing that you have the ability to transform it is already a huge gift in this on its own. You can speak for yourself, like right now how you feel, and there's moments where you feel, you know, you mentioned like despair and very like in your mind and all of this. Do you always feel like this?
I cycle quick, man. I one day is sunny and storms come in. The thing that's challenging for me is that when the sun's shining, I think it shines all the time. And I make all these grand plans about everything I'm going to do. And when the storms come in, it's like, it is never going to end. And I know that it's going to end.
Right.
But I think that there's a feeling of getting stuck in suffering that many people have. Mm-hmm. And we see that also in these maladies of the mind, depression, anxiety, yes. OCD, yes. post-traumatic stress disorder. And what I've learned through work with psychedelics and the understanding of current research on why they're so helpful is that our minds are getting into thought forms and getting stuck in those thought forms and running them over and over again. And so that makes sense to me. And it makes sense that changing those thought forms, because obviously, you know, it doesn't work to do high doses of psychedelics every day. You know, it's kind of like, I feel like psychedelics like point the way, but they don't walk it for you.
Yeah.
What is your primary tool for working with the mind that causes suffering and cultivating more joy in your life? And maybe not what is your primary tool, but what are some tools that you use?
Well, the biggest one is meditation.
And what style of meditation?
Vipassana.
Yeah, I already knew, but for the sake of the audience, we're having a Vipassana talk in a minute.
Yeah, so Vipassana is the main one. I think really exploring creative expression and music, for me it's music, and really diving deep into this has been so helpful in like allowing myself to find new ways of expressing myself. I think that's very important. And time in nature is the most beautiful one. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about joy and what it can give to you. And oftentimes these discussions are, you know, kind of like centered to us. But the most beautiful thing about joy is that it's giving. And it's sharing it with others.
It's contagious.
I never saw myself as a joyful person. I put joy at the end of my name on Instagram because people started to say, "You are joy, you are joy, you are joy." It was projected on me.
It's because you've got a cute smile. And you laugh a lot. People are like, that's a joyful man. And so, maybe you're French.
And I have my struggles and all of it. But at some point I was like, okay, people see that in me. I have to dive deeper into it. And so that's what I started to do. Because at first I was not seeing myself necessarily as different as other people. And I'm still maybe not different right now. But I go through all these moments. I go through all the cycles as well. Now, what I learned through meditation and some psychedelics in my past is how to learn when something serves me or not. And that for me is the biggest point. It's like recognizing what experiences or what choices I make that will serve me or not.
And I like the expression releasing what doesn't serve me and attending to what serves me. But just to go a little closer into that, how do you know what serves you? Because sometimes it sure does seem like an ecstatic experience is what's going to serve me, and it's going to make me feel so unlocked and open, and I'm going to use this tool, which is this drug or this relationship that right now feels good but may feel bad later. And these things that seem to bring me joy in the moment and seem to be refuge in the moment, you know, the tax collector always comes to pay on those experiences. You know, what you purchase pain with all that joy can give. And as the poet, Alexander Pope says, purchase pain with all that joy can give, and die of nothing but a rage to live.
Mm. That's beautiful. And I love how you always see the subject from one angle to the other. I think for my understanding is that what serves you, and that's why it's actually hard to like explain, because it's not like check this box and then it serves you. That's good. Yeah, there's not, as you say, like template. So that's why it requires some level of understanding of where you are at, what you need to get where you want to go. So it really depends who you want to become. Like when I close my eyes and I'm like, who I want to be? Like, how do I want to show up?
You see Eamon, don't you?
I see Eamon. I see you right in front of me.
I think you might be ahead of me, to be honest.
No, but yeah, and that's a good point. You know, like you, and who do you see? Who are you? Who are the people you see yourself like becoming closer to? I have a spiritual teacher. I call him my mystic companion. He's a friend and he's a teacher, and he's been practicing with such discipline and concentration and mindfulness. Like when I'm with him, like there is no doubt that he inspires me to become a better person. So yeah, that's how I perceive it personally. It's like who I want to become.
Yeah, the mentorship is so key. I have a mentor, Benjamin, who has given me so much time for like the past 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And I can speak to him and I can tease out that very question. And I like the twin concepts of karma and dharma. And he and I were just speaking about this. And what he said is, it's not really a matter of morality. It's a matter of identity. When you make a choice that turns a karmic wheel, it will lead to more choices.
Yes.
When you take a choice that turns a dharmic wheel, or as the Burmese say, dhammic, the dhamma, dhamma.
Yeah.
When you turn the wheel of dhamma, this beautiful dhamma.
Yeah.
We're starting to talk about Vipassana already. The beautiful dhamma. That we're making a choice. And I think that, so for people listening who are interested in cultivating joy from a spiritual perspective, not simply, you know, happiness or hedonistic bliss.
Yes, but that's very important to distinguish that.
But for those who are wanting to cultivate joy with consistency, you've mentioned a couple of things. The mentorship is important because, yes, you know, you need help sometimes deciding whether a choice is going to take you where you want to go and even where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned creativity, Vipassana meditation, and nature. And so I think that to start, let's go with creativity first.
Yeah.
Because you are a DJ, you're a musician, you're a flautist. You ended up having a beautiful time quarantined on the island of Bali playing flute, and it was so lovely to watch. My God, I was so jealous and just delighted. Let's start with creativity. And I want to talk to you about this with an ear to our audience, and especially for those listening who are building creative practices. You are an accomplished musician. You DJ for Daybreaker, for example. You've done a lot with your work in music. So for those listening who are interested in cultivating joy through creative expression, what advice do you have? Because at least me in creative work, sometimes creative work can be very painful and very lonely. And especially if you're not very good yet, it's hard to keep going. Yeah. And you know, you want to find an audience. So can you kind of contextualize your creative journey as a pursuit of joy for us?
Yeah, it's funny. Like my creative journey is so like, I never decided that I'm going to plan it. It just unfolded so naturally. And I think that's in a way something that get me free from being in bondage with it. But when I felt in bondage with it, I had to let go of many things. So I left the duo I was part of in 2020.
Yeah, can you build that up for us? Tell us a bit about that duo and how you got involved before you tell us how you let go.
12 years ago, with my best friend at the time, we created a duo called FDVM. And so we decided to play Coachella, Tomorrowland, all the big festival, play all the Burning Man things. And It was magical. However, we started in France and I moved to America. And so we started to play under the same name, different shows at the same time, actually, which was interesting and also confusing for people. But through time, we evolved differently and our taste for music changed. And in 2020, when I landed in Bali, he called me and he said, I want to continue the project by myself.
I want a divorce.
I want a divorce. That was my second divorce.
Yeah, so that's your second divorce.
That was my second divorce. It was both something I really wanted and needed, but also both something I knew would be very difficult. So it was expected on my side. Like I knew that was coming, but also it was painful. It was really, really painful. But it gave me such freedom because I was being so bounded to the style of music I was making with him. And he had a different vision. For him, it was all about making money that music that sells and all of this. And I already had started another project on my own called Soul Potion. So I already tried to find other ways of creation that was not like in that container. It was very important for me. So yeah, that happened. And in that process, I've been kind of not pursuing DJing anymore. And funny enough, since I did that, it's been way more exciting.
Yeah, you DJed with Sufis on Saturday.
Yeah, that was absolutely beautiful. Way more exciting, and I kind of reconnected with the passion of music too. I also missed out some points that, you know, we became super famous in Pakistan, and that on its own was such an adventure.
Yeah, the duo became famous in Pakistan.
Yeah. I went by myself at first, but he joined me there.
What years crazy. Were you in Pakistan?
2018 and 19. Actually, I was there when the world shut down and to Bali just before.
I remember, because we were friends at that time, and yeah. I remember seeing on Instagram, like, you were like famous in Pakistan. You were like a big deal in Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, it just was so unexpected. It just was so random the way it unfolded there. And I'm so grateful for the adventure. But what I'm the most touched by is the way I was welcomed into some villages where I was the first foreigner, white person to ever visit them, and they did concert for me. And then I went to back and like played the largest Sufi folk music festival of Pakistan, and they actually just called me back like a few days ago to go back again. All of this to say that there is, for me, it's this deep passion, and you saw it here, is like connecting like music in like a traditional way and an electronic way, and like bring it together. It has been like such a thread in my production of music. And so expanding the cultural discoveries, understanding cultures, has been so beautifully enriching in my journey. And that's how the flute also unfolded.
So let's tease out some things from that we can give to young artists.
Yeah.
Because, you know, who doesn't want to be big in Pakistan? I'll tell you. And not that you have a playbook or a formula, but the focus is cultivating joy. So can you share leaning into the artistic process, the process of creation? Maybe it's in part about not being so focused on the fruits of labor, which is your experience, very Bhagavad Gita, you know, do the work, but don't be attached to the fruits of labor. Mm-hmm. Let's do some advice time for the young ones.
Okay, yeah, that's a big one. Like, really don't be attached to it. It's so easy to get stuck into like the recognition. I deserve more recognition. And then you get stuck into it, and that doesn't help the process of creation. I think one also important point is don't limit yourself creatively. Like, just explore as much as you can and explore what you love. Like, what talks to your heart, what resonates with your heart. Don't do it because people are doing it and it's successful. Don't do it because, you know, it's the trend. Just do it because you absolutely love it. And I think that's where, I know I went a bit everywhere, but the way I was speaking about my second divorce leaving FDVM, it's like I got to reconnect with what I absolutely love and not like lose myself into what the industry wanted me to produce.
Mm. This reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from the German poet Rilke, from his collection Letters to a Young Poet. Mm. And it's my favorite piece of advice for young artists, which is, I beg of you, have patience with all that is unresolved in your heart and learn to love the questions themselves like little locked rooms or books in a very foreign tongue. You can't be given the answers now because you would not be able to live them.
Yes.
And the point is to live everything. So live the questions now, and perhaps some distant day you may live your way into the answers.
That's very beautiful.
Isn't it great?
That's very beautiful.
I literally, if I talk to someone under 30, that quote probably pops out at some point. Because that's the thing, you know, I think that's the thing with the creative process. we want to be big in Pakistan. We want to be these things. We want to feel this recognition. We want people to listen to what we're creating.
Yes.
But I don't think that that is what brings joy.
It's not. The creative process is what brings you joy. And that's very important to remember that for everybody who's making music, because if the creative process is not joyful, it's not a passionate unfolding in this moment, then it becomes an industry and a business, and you lose like the sweetness of it.
So the creative process may bubble up again in this conversation, but let's now go to being in nature, which is, let's be honest, a fairly straightforward invitation. Nature is obviously, it's emotionally regulating. There's this Japanese practice of forest bathing, which simply means go out in the world.
Yes.
I myself find that being in nature is very regulating and easeful. Is there anything surprising about your experiences in nature that bring you joy? Is there anything that maybe when you were younger, you didn't quite get about being in nature that is really important to you now?
Nature is just fantastic. It's just phenomenal, especially when you slow down with it, meaning you are going in a state of meditation into nature. It's a whole psychedelic experience. You don't need any substances for it. You can talk to the leaves and hug the trees, and it's absolutely mind-blowing.
Quick question. Are you addicted to social media?
How do I define addiction for social media?
Well, here's the reason I bring it up. I can't go out in nature without my fucking phone. And what I do is I'm in awe of nature. I'm in awe and I love the feeling of awe. So what do I do when I feel awe? Take out my phone.
I wanna share it.
Take a photo. Come with a witty caption. I'm in this beautiful place. I'm feeling awe. And there's a sense that it's not even about me feeling awe. It's about the moment that that feeling bubbles up in me, I want to capture it.
Yes.
And I want to use it as part of my projection of self into the world, into the digital town hall. And that somehow that will amplify my experience of it, that it will no longer be fleetingly a sensory experience, but I'll be able to own it and it'll be mine and I will be witnessed in it. And so when I ask, are you addicted to social media? I wonder, you know, are you able to go out into nature without your phone and feel awe and just have it be your own? Or is your joy co-opted for some other purpose?
Yeah, no, I really make sure I don't spend time on my phone when I'm in nature. I spend all my birthdays in silence. So I go on long walks. When I say silence, it's been disconnected completely. So these are the most beautiful moments. And I know we're going to get to Vipassana, but also in Vipassana, when you spend 10 hours a day in meditation and you look at the insects and the leaves and the trees, it's just everything has another dimension to it. And it's very beautiful. The sharing on social media happens as well, for sure. I think it's inherent that when we experience something beautiful, we want to share it.
What's interesting is the most activating emotion for sharing is awe. The second most activated emotion for sharing is anger. So, and things that are not activating, contentment is not activating. Interestingly, grief, well, not grief so much as like melancholy is not really activating,
Wow.
But different emotion, there's a different emotional range of activation, and social media marketers obviously utilize this.
They know that.
So it's like, you wouldn't believe how the Grand Canyon was this way or whatever. Or it's like, how dare this, you know, single father do this, pithy sort of like title is, but you know, it's played on.
But for social media, for my own social media, for example, when I have a moment of, I don't share it to see how cool I am, how amazing my life is. I share it to be like, how can this inspire others? That's very much a narrative. And again, like that's this idea that I won't say like, I'm of service by sharing beautiful things on my Instagram, but how I can, maybe there's people looking at it and be like, I actually need to go in nature right now. That's what I need.
You touched on Vipassana, and I knew that this was going to be a big part of our conversation. And I too have whiled away the potentially interminable hours enjoying nature. I've done Vipassana in two locations, as have you. First was in Canada, in a much humbler kind of like no golden pagoda, it's a converted old folks home. But the weather patterns across the fields were marvelous. And then recently, 2 months ago, I did one at Dhammapitaka in South Africa, which is an excellent, excellent center, beautiful, these extraordinary like purple orange mountains and rows of eucalyptus trees, which I know are not native to that part of the world, and bougainvillea kind of traipsing along the yard, and very special. Some of the memories that were most interesting to me were my interactions with nature. And in fact, there at one point, a full-on tortoise, like a large tortoise, just came lumbering and beelined to me and started eating the weeds at my foot. And whatever else I got from Vipassana, I got that. I mean, there was even like a half-eaten rat that got kind of swooped on by an owl. And I just looking and being eaten by ants, and even that in that moment was like so fascinating.
Cycle of life.
Yeah, just all of it. So I like the nature part of Vipassana. There are things I don't like about Vipassana, which we'll get into. But let's talk about your relationship. How did you first get into this meditation practice? What inspired you to sit? And for those listening, this is 10 days of silent meditation. And Victorian, if you could share a little bit more about what Vipassana is and how you approached it.
Yeah. So Vipassana is thought to be the direct teachings of Buddha. Not Buddhism, but the direct teachings of Buddha. The teachings that Buddha was giving on the tree. And Goenkaji, who brought these teachings from Burma to India, brought it to the West and recorded a series of meditations that are now packed into 10 days. And there is more than 180 centers around the world where it's all on donation based. And people can go and experience that immersion within themselves. So how did I fall into it? After my divorce, I had done plant medicine and psychedelics, and I was just like, there must be something else. And somebody was talking about Vipassana, and I was like, I'll never do this. Are you crazy? 10 days in silence.
Yeah, everybody's like, how would you do the silence? It's like, bro, the silence is not the hard part.
Yeah, how do you see the pain and all of it? And I heard myself say this, and I was like, you know what? You should try it.
What year was this?
That was 2018. So I did it. It was my birthday. So I did my birthday in the middle of... The second day was my birthday. It was quite magical. So that's what drawn me to it. And I have to say, it is a very challenging meditation. It requires a lot of discipline. And so I kind of had a relationship with it, like kind of a love and hate relationship with it.
I don't know one person who does not have a love and hate relationship with Vipassana. I certainly do. And it's leaned a little more on the side of hate lately. A little more, just
can,
a little bit.
We can talk about that one. But
we're gonna. you're gonna help me find joy in it.
No, but it's like, it's since I have a teacher now, it has changed everything for me.
It changed your relationship to the meditation practice?
Yes.
And is this teacher
the importance of it?
And is this teacher specifically a Vipassana meditation teacher?
No. He's in India. And he's not like a teacher per se. I said earlier, he's a mystic companion. He's a friend. He's like almost a family member. And he's like, he has lived and he is walking the path in such a way that is mind-blowing.
That's like my Benjamin. Same thing. It's mystical like, companion. Love
wow.
it.
Wow. It's like,
what's his name?
His name is Amrit Pal Singh. His given name by his teacher is Guru Mukh. I can give a little bit of a story about him. He was given by his parents to a master when he was 7 years old. Until 19, he lived in the monastery. At 19, he left the monastery because he wanted to learn English. And then he got married, got a kid, and started to work in IT. And then now he's decided to come back to spirituality because that's his gift.
Wow. So yeah. IT guru. He's like the IT department of your soul.
Kind of.
Yeah, right?
I guess I could be putting that way for sure. It's more in the heart though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not in the mind, like with numbers.
Wait, did you know him before you went to Vipassana the first time?
I met him in Bali.
Okay. So he's a recent companion.
Yeah. Yeah. And so since he came into my life, things have taken a different meaning.
Mm. Well, let's stay with the first Vipassana in 2018, yeah, before you met him. So you decided, I don't want to do it, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, that which you do not wish to do is what you must do, which is some sort of stoic blah, blah, blah. Lord. So you decided to do it. Second day was your birthday. Tell us a little bit about that experience. What was it like? So you've 10 days.
Yeah.
You don't speak to anyone. You don't look at anyone. You're meditating 10 and a half hours a day. You wake at 4 a.m. It's hard.
Yeah. It's. I don't like the word to use hard, so it's challenging.
Okay, challenging. Fine.
And well, it was funny because the day of my birthday, I wake up, you know, for the 4 a.m. meditation, and I'm like, let's do it. And I sit in my room and I fainted. So most of people might see it as like I kind of like lost my identity. I don't know what, but I completely passed out and I opened my eyes and I was still in the black and I didn't know my name, where I was or any of this. It was quite crazy. So I was like, whoa, this is going to be very, very hard. But then it went much better. It was a very profound experience. You know, as I mentioned, I've done psychedelics and trips to Peru and ayahuasca and all of this. Being in a sober state and experiencing such depths and transcendence without looking for it or making it like a goal was so, so, so powerful. Yes, this moment of pain and deep struggle and the mind for the first 3-4 days is non-stop going, and this person and this and that and this and this. It's really difficult, really challenging, and it's also like the process of purging all this nonsense that our mind makes and all these things that are not serving us. And I think in that process you really realize like, what do I want to do in my life, who I want to become, what do I need to do to get there?
Well, there is an extraordinary privilege to spending 10 days.
That's true.
Being able to observe the way your mind works with no distractions.
That's such a blessing, and it's so rare.
And you really can't blame anyone. As much as I blame Goenka, I get so mad at Goenka. Goenka, of course, is the person who proliferated this particular type of meditation. And also you listen to him on the tapes and you see him on the video.
Yes.
And I very much externalize my frustration at my own pain in my body and my own wayward mind. And I'm like, you're wrong. You're wrong about things. My gripe is that I don't believe in reincarnation. I don't believe that life is suffering. I believe life has suffering and that these tools are helpful. This is something I want to talk to you about on the podcast. What sticks in my craw on this, and it is a beautiful practice and I've gotten a lot out of it. And I went back a second time, you know, as miserable as it was, I did it again. But my issue is that the narrative of life as suffering and that you suffer and that you accumulate karma and that you die and that you get pumped right back into it with all the karma from before, to me, it's just so much of the original sin, fire and brimstone of Catholicism. It's like there's something wrong with us, and that's our karmic load that we have, and we have to go through these miserable cycles. And only if we stumble upon this particular kind of meditation, which to me is analogous to like Christian salvation. If and only if you take the Lord Jesus as your personal God and Savior, then you can be saved from the suffering. And to me, on a metaphysical level, that's not true for me. And so in Vipassana, that aspect, that philosophical or metaphysical aspect, I just rage against it. And I just find myself so mad about that is what we're doing. And of course, I'm denying myself the obvious fruits of the meditation itself by being pissed off at this dude for having a different metaphysical belief than me. But I'm curious, do you...
Would you say you have resistance?
Oh,
well,
yes, I do.
Listen. First of all, I don't have all the answers, and I only know what I know why I'm in this moment. But let's talk about suffering.
Let's talk about suffering on our Joy podcast.
Yeah, that's very important. We can agree that suffering exists.
Yes.
Everywhere, in everyone's life.
And most of the time.
And most of the time.
Very frequently.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, I complain so much.
So if you pass and I say life is suffering, you don't disagree.
I don't think that life is suffering. I think that life has suffering. It just happens to have a lot of suffering for most people.
Yeah. Now, there is a way. There is a few ways, I'm guessing, but there is a way that has been walked by Buddha. Buddha transcended all sufferings. it's possible. But it requires a certain process. It requires really, really strong discipline. And it requires strong values. So Vipassana and Goenka, they never say that life is only suffering. They just look at how life is, and there is a lot of suffering. And they offer a way that has been walked before. It's different than Catholicism or Christianism, because it's not about praying somebody or something and you're going to go to hell or heaven. There's none of that. It's like somebody has walked the path. This is what they taught. If you want to free yourself, to truly free yourself, these are the steps. That's what all the great saints are talking about. Even Jesus, what is in the Bible, is probably not what Jesus taught. What Jesus taught is probably very different. It's in the same way, you know, what potentially in Buddhism, there's so many types of Buddhism, it's not what Buddha was teaching necessarily. And that's what Vipassana claims to be. I'm not saying it's the truth, it's the only way, it's the only answer, but that's what it says. So if you dedicatedly, whatever the word is, walk this path, there is a way for liberation. There might be other ways for liberation. Everybody can walk their own path, but we know that Buddha has walked this path. Buddha is, by far, the most known person in the world. There is a Buddha in every house, in every place. Buddha, 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 everybody talks about him. The guy never used social media, never used wars, never used any of these powers other than walking the path. And you look at all the great saints, and it's the same thing. There is something deep there. And we can ignore it if we want to, but we can also look at it and see the beauty of it and see the sacrifice and the work, the hard work. Like if you look at the life of Buddha and all these saints, it's beyond any work that every other human has done. It's like going through the suffering of the world. I'm talking about it right now, and I hope it's received humbly, and I'm not pretending to know much more than anyone else, but I'm just trying to bring some light into like these realities. Like these are things that happened. And if we understand them, hopefully they can awaken in our heart this devotion and this deep passion for self-exploration.
So if you believe that this is the path, this is the path for you, this is a path, but a certain path, why are you not in Vipassana right now? Why aren't you doing this every chance you get? Because from what I understand from Vipassana, what you're doing is you're scanning your body. And this is, you know, for the audience who is not familiar with Vipassana, you're observing your body, you're observing sensations. You're recognizing that in any moment, your mind is creating craving or aversion, and you're meeting that with equanimity instead. So you're developing a steadiness and an equanimity. And then over time, that starts to kind of shave off all these, they say impurities, and the impurities leave sankaras, you, yeah. And the sankaras. But the process is this, you know, you sit, you do the scan. It's a long, rather arduous process of this body scan technique, Vipassana. If you believe that this is the one and the one for you, why are you not doing this constantly? Why are you not taking every retreat you can? Because it's just a matter of time, according to this teaching, it's just a matter of time that you just do this process again and again and again, that you'll achieve enlightenment. So why aren't you doing that?
Well, I'm doing once or twice a year.
Do you do the 2 hours a day?
I do between 30 minutes to 1 hour a day.
Okay.
So still good. I try my best in that sense.
I also don't like, because Goenka's like, 2 hours a day, and then the retreats, and then he's just...
Yeah, I mean, you may not like it. But again, that's what they suggest for you. It's for you. It's not for them. They have nothing to gain from it. Vipassana is on donation base, by the way, for everyone who knows to know that. It's on donation base. They have nothing to gain from it. But they have walked the path. So they're just telling you, listen, if you want to get to a certain state, which is the most beautiful state, these are the steps. No, nothing in the world, and no one in the world will be able to like carry you and bring down to the steps and be like, okay, you arrived. And these are, unfortunately, you know, it's also a reason why I'm sober and I'm not taking substances, because that's a lot of belief of people, is that I'm going to take a shortcut and I'm going to get there. It's hard work. It's really, really hard work. and one has to do it. Why I'm not doing it every day and why I'm not Vipassana every day? Because I'm not as dedicated as I think I am.
Yeah, because it's hard.
It's super hard.
It's awful.
It's super hard. No, I'm trying my best. And Vipassana is not made for monks. It's made also for people who have families and build a life. And all. Vipassana doesn't tell you become a monk. You, as long as you establish right livelihood, and there's a few more pillars that I don't have right now, but there's a few pillars that are important. So it doesn't say like live your life in constant meditation and be enlightened. It actually may not be the goal. You know, my goal is not to be enlightened, but it's to...
What is your goal?
To become the best possible person I can become. So I can serve best those around me.
You know, and I dig it. I dig it. And I think one of the risks when you get too preoccupied with the spiritual path is that you might lose your humor. Which, of course, as anyone knows, if a guru isn't laughing, then you should run the other direction. But there's kind of an epidemic of lost personal growth junkiness.
Yes.
You know, like yes. I've been a poster child of this thing. It's like, go drink the ayahuasca and then go do the workshop, unlock your butthole, do the secret special rites and rituals. And I think that we get preoccupied with our own personal journeys and our own personal relationship to what we think needs to be healed. So how do we make sure that we're cultivating joy at the same time that we're doing the very serious work of just getting the impurities out and growing and all that kind of stuff? Like, how do you keep yourself humble and silly?
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's a very important point. It's so important. It's beyond. And so many people take it way, way too seriously.
It's so boring when they do. I hate it.
And I think it lies in playfulness also. And we have to understand that it's kind of a game, right? That we're playing. And we play different characters. And you choose the one you want to play, you know? For me, it's one realization in the last few years is also like, pick a path, choose your path, and walk it humbly. Don't pretend you know more than what you know. And don't judge others from the path they are walking either. There's no such a thing as the path. Right, there's different paths and everybody's at different levels on different paths and we're all trying to support one another in that. I think that's the most beautiful thing. And keep laughing at yourself. I think that's important.
I want to talk about your sobriety. How long have you been sober now?
3 years.
You've been sober for 3 years and that includes...
Everything.
Microdosing, everything. Ayahuasca ceremonies, everything. A sound ceremony with a rock star everything. Shaman from Topanga.
Everything. You
know, okay.
Coffee.
Coffee.
I don't drink caffeine.
You don't even drink caffeine? Yeah. Okay. So I've been sober for 4 months.
Woohoo! Everybody applaud.
Hey, me. I'm so good.
How do you feel?
Well, so what's interesting is that the sobriety itself has been similar to the Vipassana in a sense that I'm able to observe my mind. So it wasn't like I was like a reckless drug abuser, but I definitely had like a rock star lifestyle where it's lots of travel and adventure and substances and ceremonies, all these sorts of things. And I decided that I would take a break and be sober for a while. And it gave me the opportunity to observe my mind. And I was able to see the degree to which I was self-medicating with substances and how I would try to run away from an experience I didn't want with a substance. And then I would have a negative experience after the come down or, you know, suicide Tuesdays or whatever it is. And I would reason that what was going on is just, I do substances and sometimes, and they take me up and then they take me down. But it was interesting being sober allowed me to see like, there's a lot of ups and downs in my mental health and psychologically that are happening independent of any of that. And there's a bit of a, you know, the mind is stilled by being allowed to be left alone. It's like water. Muddy water is stilled by being left alone. So that's been my experience. But it seems like, particularly in Burning Man community writ large, that the drugs are fun. And when you're not on the drugs, it's not as fun. I'm curious what your experience of that has been.
Did I not have fun here?
Yeah, I mean, I've had fun. But I didn't have all the fun. There was fun had that I didn't get to have. I left some fun on the table.
I was asking you, do you see me not having fun?
Oh, did I see you? No, you, well, that's the thing. You're like the poster child of joy. You always seem to be having fun. Although there was one day where I thought you might be a bit like annoyed, and I was so happy. I was like, is Victorian not full of joy and smiles today? I was like,
and that happens very often, actually. But yeah, there's so much to be said on that. I don't even know where to start.
Well, let's start with, why did you decide to become sober?
So it's a few things. And it was very gradual. I don't even know what started it. I started to like stop slowly things. Maybe because I was in the music industry and, you know, parties and alcohol all the time. I was like, okay, let me stop drinking liquor. And all of it is, again, to the same point. It's like, as soon as I recognize if it serves me or not, I wake up with such a headache, and then I have another gig, and I wake up. It's like, you know, it's such a cycle. It goes on and on and on. It's free alcohol and blah, blah, blah. And I just felt like I was not at my best. So I was like, okay, let me stop by drinking liquor. So I was only drinking beer and wine. And like this, I applied for everything. Smoking, weed, like all of it. Absolutely all of it. And then I met my teacher, and that changed everything. He kind of gave me like a container in which we could relate to one another. He didn't tell me, don't do it, but he said, if you want us to work together, these are understandings you need to have. The last thing I did in my journey was 5-MeO. I was in Bali.
Just say what 5-MeO is for the audience.
5-MeO DMT is the frog.
The Sonoran desert toad.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a ceremony, and I was told that it was this very profound.
Had you done it before?
No. I mean, like, casually.
You'd done DMT, but not 5-MeO.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
They are different. Yeah, different molecules.
They're different. So I was like, sure, let's do it. My friend was like, yeah, let's do a ceremony. And I was like, all right, let's do it. I laughed the entire time. I was cracking up laughing, and only one message came out. You know. Not that I know everything, far from that. You know what you need to do to walk this path that you want to walk, to become this person you want to become. I got the message, and I was like, okay, I'm done with every of it, like absolutely everything. For me, it was clear.
And was so, it hard so for it, you?
No, it was kind of like...
So when you're at a party and people are just like cavorting in all manner of ways, and they're like, here's some of like the best MDMA, like it was made in a lab in Berkeley, like come on, join us, there's a sex party happening, like blah.
There's absolutely no desire awakening in my body when all of this is happening. I can't explain it really. It's just like, I know I don't need it. So it's just like, okay, blank. I drink my sparkling water and I'm like,
do you get sleepy?
Super happy. When? When I need to go to bed? Yeah.
I mean, like, I...
Life changes, of course. You don't stay up until sunrise every day, or less often at least, because priorities change. Priorities are, I want to wake up and do my morning practice and these kind of things. But what is unfolding for me with substances is this idea, and you mentioned it, after 3 months, how exciting it is to explore the mind from a default state. How incredibly exciting. It's actually the only moment in your life when you can actually clearly see. Because as you mentioned with substances, psychedelics or not all of them, don't get me wrong, they can be wonderful tools. They help me a lot when I needed them, but they are medicine. And just like any other medicine, you take them to heal. And once you are healed from the thing you take them for, you don't need them anymore. If you have a headache, you take an Advil. You don't take an Advil every day.
Well, you might have to take Prozac every day if you got what I've got.
Okay, well, but because you have it every day, it's something that you are healing, right? You're in the process of healing it, so you need it. That's fair. But why a person goes to do a certain ceremony, maybe at some point will be healed. And when that is healed, there is no need for it anymore.
Do you think that you would do it again? Do you think something might come up in your life where you're like, I mean, I want to do an ayahuasca ceremony. This feels right for me. Or does it feel to you like, I'm done. This is the life I want. I don't see me opening that door again.
I don't have an answer to that question, to be honest. Like, I think in this moment that I'm done, and that I know something that is even more powerful than all of this. That's my person. That's my that personal belief. But who knows in the future? This can change. It has changed already. So, but what was incredible, I come back to it, is this idea of exploring the mind from a sober state. Because when you do experiences, you change the state, right? You go to this peak and then you come down. And then, for example, for an experience like ayahuasca, you need to live at least 6 months, maybe a year, to come back to a default state where the mind is refocused normal. So it's very rare, if people who are doing substances, for them to find themselves in a stable state of mind. And I think there's nothing more beautiful to explore the mind from that state. Otherwise, you keep hijacking it. And how do you want to find something? You keep moving around. It's very difficult.
Because you don't really want to find it. You want to distract yourself from it. You want to hide yourself from the things that you don't want, even if it's as boring and mundane as just simple boredom. And we're in such a distracted culture. There's anything you want all the time, if you have the privilege to pay for it, but it's like cheeseburger, social media, 5-MeO DMT, let's go.
Yes, and I live in India now. And it's been very interesting to, through all this process of the past 3-4 years, to also watch like how in the West, everything become capitalized. Substances become capitalized, spirituality becomes capitalized, and everything becomes a business of more and more and more and more expensive and more expensive, and we're losing the sweetness of it all. And that's why I feel so blessed to be connected to a teacher who is in India. He never charged me anything. I support him and his family in the ways that I want. But he never told me, okay, Vic, for 1 hour, it's that much. Because he told me, I'll never put a price on this. There's no price. Once you attach a price to it, it's a transaction. You give me this, and I'll give you that. A spiritual teacher, a true spiritual teacher, he doesn't exactly know what he's going to give you. Yeah. Because it depends where you are, the way you do the work, and how you're going to evolve in the future. No one knows this. So the way we've moved everything into extreme capitalism and we apply it to spirituality and we apply it to substances, it unfortunately takes all the essence out of it. And I think what we need to, and I try to awaken in my heart as well, and we need to introduce more to the West, is devotion. Because we lost that. We're not raised with it in the West. And I think it brings such depth of commitment and passion in the heart for this longing that I want to find myself. We lost that. Actually, maybe we don't lost it. We never had it in the West. And now it's the time, I think, to bring it back. And you were at our concert two nights ago. And that's one of the efforts to try to reintroduce that. When I talk about reintroducing to the West, I talk about myself as well. I've been learning a lot about the way spirituality has been done in the East, and you know, with the respect to the teacher and all of this, it's fascinating. It's so super profound, and we have to understand why it's there. It's there for a reason.
Is devotion the path to joy?
It is definitely a big pillar of it. Yeah, it's a big pillar of it. You know, it's the same as the beginning I was saying. It's like you have to believe it. You know, you have to believe that there is this inner vibration inside of you. There's this joy vibration that's always there. And you can always tune into it. And so devotion takes faith. It's the same thing. You just have to believe that this can awaken within you.
There's a beautiful poem from Rumi that I should probably commit to memory because I love it so much and I don't have it committed to memory, but it talks about how sorrow prepares you for joy and it comes into your house and it moves everything out. It shakes the dead leaves, pulls up the rotten roots, and in so doing, it prepares your heart for joy. How do you feel about embracing sorrow, letting go, releasing, and grieving as a path to joy? Is that part of how you activate joy in your life, letting things go?
Yeah, I mean, the Dalai Lama speaks about it a lot. And pain and suffering and everything you just described is part of it. You have to go through that too. You know, it's not like, oh, everything is bubbly and beautiful and the leaves are singing. It's not like that. It's very much part of it. you have to go through these challenges of life to transcend things. It's very important, very important.
Victorian, what's on the horizon for you now? So you are walking this path. I'm presuming you'll continue to sit in 10-day retreats. You'll continue to work with Vipassana meditation. You'll continue to spend time in nature. What are you excited about on the horizon? And what are your efforts moving forward as you mature spiritually and creatively?
In the past 6 years, I've been playing flutes. And that's been taking a whole new meaning for me to play an instrument and to dive within this instrument and to completely like dissolve with the instrument. So I definitely want to share that more and more. For me, like, there's two main points. It's like, how can I continue to grow and be the best person I can be, and how I can be of service to others. And I feel frustration these days, actually, that I'm not enough of service to others. Like, that's something that I've experienced in my life when I was in Bali and in India as well, but I feel like I'm not enough of service to others. And I think a lot of talks in the spiritual realm and in the West is how we can develop ourselves and becoming better. But the most important thing is not that, is how can we be of service to others?
And so how are you going to be doing that?
Well, with my partner, Monica, the idea is to, we got together 2 years ago, so now we want to like kind of merge our life, continue to merge our life and like build a stable unit. And then from that place, we would love to give as much as we can through bringing music to schools in India and ultimately building schools and orphanage and support like that. Yeah, that's very like at the center of our intention.
That's beautiful. How can we support you and where can we follow your journey? For those who are being introduced to you on this podcast for the first time, where shall we direct them?
Yeah, I'm on at Victorian Joy on Instagram, VictorianJoy. Joy. And I think, you know, we are doing this meditative concert and that's, you experience it. And we had 500 candles 2 nights ago and it was very beautiful. I really want to bring these ones to many, many places for sure.
Did you have, we're here at Experience House in Morocco, which is a collection of experienced designers and other creatives. And it's a place to prototype certain things. So were you prototyping that meditation here or had you done it prior?
We've done it a few times before. Okay. But this was definitely the first time we could have like that many candles. Such a
we had the
space.
Most candles.
We had the most candles.
Nice.
Actually, no, that's not true. And it can't be true because I don't want to have the most of anything.
Ah, touche. But do you feel that you benefited from being in this container of Experience House and yes. learned things here?
Yes, yes. So much.
I did too. A little shout out to the Experience House folks and Sam Kern and the whole team who had both Victorian and I out here where we got to do this podcast.
Such beautiful container.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Creativity and relationships and friendships.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, brother.
It's such a pleasure. Yay. It's so nice to be in your infectious joy. And I think that, you know, part of the joy too is the humor, not taking it so seriously. Yes, self-pity sometimes, but also laugh at it too. And that's what I try to do. I mean, for the listener about my path to joy, it's just like, keep it light, baby. Keep it light. It's only a human life. It's so precious yes. and so fleeting, but it's just yes. a human life.
Yes.
You're just getting to play one character for 80 years if you're lucky. And then there's something else.
Or you can play many characters.
Or you can play many characters. That's true. I like to play many characters. Victorian, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been such a great experience speaking with you.
Thank you.
Boom. We're done. Feel complete? Yeah, there's always a
you
sense.
You never clarified the Vipassana why you don't like Goenka. I feel like there's no completion on that.
There's no completion on why I don't like Goenka?
Yeah.
No completion about why I don't like Goenka. I don't not like Goenka. I'm obviously projecting onto him my despair at the whole project. But I just, he's so bossy. I love him and he's full of Dhamma and the Dhamma is so good. But I just, it doesn't feel up to date with the times. It feels patriarchal and it feels kind of like, it's just kind of bossy. And I find my natural rebellious self is like, fuck you. I don't want the cardamom seeds, bro. And I get it. I know what you're going to say. Like, he's so full of love and he walked the path and all he wants to share it. He's not benefiting. He's dead after all. And it's ridiculous for me to like be mad at him. But it just feels, it feels like a game of spiritual Simon Says. where you wake up in the prison and you got to fucking sit there while someone lectures you about some spiritual metaphysics that I don't align with. So that's what gets me about Goenka.
I find it so interesting. And listen, your experience is your experience. And I get some part of it. But none of what he says matters. The meditation itself is what matters. Your experience of the meditation is what matters.
And so here's the thing. I'm down for Vipassana as a meditation. And I would love to do a 10-day silent retreat. And I would love to do a 10-day silent retreat with a very esteemed Western teacher like Jack Kornfield or Tara Brach. I just think the Western psyche is so conceptual. And obviously we're working with the Western psyche. But it's such an austere practice, and there's so much distance between me and a dead Burmese businessman. Blessings to him. But the full meditation, I'm down to do it. But I can't sit there and listen to those recordings. And the chanting, it doesn't land with me. All I'm doing is sitting in strong determination, waiting to hear Anicca, Anicca, Anicca. Just give me circa 2023 Vipassana. Give me something with a little... Give me a little sex appeal. I'm joking about that. Obviously, the sex appeal is probably going to just be distracting.
Whatever works for you. I hope you find it.
Oh, fuck you. No, I know. I know you're, no, being, I know you're being sincere.
No, but I hear you. I think it's okay. It's okay to have resistance to it as well. And I think it's okay to also like put your resistance to something or someone. It's...
Well, I mean, to be clear, because I'd like to include this in the podcast, to be clear, I think it's an incredible container, and I think it's totally worth doing. I think it's very challenging. I think it's just such an amazing way of learning about yourself. I did the first one, and it followed a certain course for me, and I learned certain things. The second one I did, it was just, the whole time was hard, and I know that that's what I'm supposed to be there to observe, but the whole time was hard, and I left feeling just exhausted. Like, I didn't leave feeling there was some kind of spiritual enlightenment, and, well, not that I would get to the point of enlightenment, but I didn't feel like I had made progress. I felt like, you know, I just...
But it's a path, and that's what's important. That it's a very important point. It's like, it's very important, and I'm so glad you had this experience. And I hope you can see it that way.
I am not glad I had
that
experience.
I hope you can see it that way. I think it's very important.
No, I do see it that way.
Look, when you have a psychedelic experience that's very challenging, right? You understand that there's teachings coming with it. It's the same thing. When you have a challenging Vipassana, my last Vipassana was so difficult. My mind was going nonstop. I felt so light afterwards, I have to say. But a path is not a straight road that goes from point A to point B, and that's it. It has to be challenging, and it's challenging for certain reasons that are, you know, your own challenges. And I have my own challenges, and anyone who goes to do Vipassana or any sort of meditation will have their own challenges. And we have to accept that this is part of the path. If we start resisting them, if we start saying like, I should not have had this hard time, or it's this guy's fault because he talked this way, we're actually not seeing the process that we are going through.
Dude, listen to this. While we're having this conversation, I'm like, wait, so I had a miserable time and I blamed it on someone who is literally dead, not even here. And you're like talking about, well, what's the lesson of the hard time? Well, maybe part of the lesson of the hard time is that when I have a hard time, I blame other people. Right? I mean, I do. I project my shit all over. I'm like, oh, it's this person's fault. It's this person's fault. But really, it's me and my own, you know, my own
noxious
mind.
And that too is a realization. And that too is an important realization for you in this moment to make and be like, okay, wow, I see that of myself. How can I not do that anymore?
I still just don't want to do a Vipassana. I don't want to do a Goenka.
You don't have to.
Again.
The most important thing is that you do it every day.
That I meditate every day? I try to meditate every day.
That's good. Yeah. That's good.
Meditation is the key. You know what? There's this excellent book for anyone who just can't deal with any mythology or any like kind of tie into quote spiritual teachings that just want technology on meditation. There's a book called The Mind Illuminated. And I forget the name of the author, but he was, you know, because you can get enlightenment is actually, I agree, it's possible. And actually it happens more, it's more common than people think that people can achieve this state. So this person followed a 10-step path, a traditional, I think it's a Theravada path. And he's a neuroscientist and wrote the 10 stages of meditation practice from a neuroscience perspective with all the things that are hard and what you need to do. And it mentions zero about anything except for the very practice itself. And I highly recommend the book. I think you'd love it. It's fascinating. And it won't replace your Vipassana practice because you love it. But it's, the mind illuminated. I'll put it in the show notes.
Beautiful.
Okay, well, there we go. I'm glad we had a little zest of my disdain for... I don't have disdain for Goenka. I see him as someone who gave with love. You know, it's just different sorts for different folks.
You know, my teacher said the other day, we were doing a satsang, and he said that hate is love repressed.
Hmm. So what you're saying is that I love Goenka, and I just need to come around to accept it. All right, Daddy Goenka, I love you. Victorian, it's been great having you on the show.
Blessings, brother.
So good to be with you during this time together, and so great to have you on my program.
Feel the same.
Thank you. I appreciate you a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.